Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. Welcome to Tides of History. China's past goes back a long, long way, but for most of us educated in North America or Europe, we didn't get much of that past in our early studies. Maybe a mention of Peking Man and archaic hominins in East Asia, maybe a little on the beginnings of the Qin Dynasty, a few check-ins in the past couple of millennia, but definitely nothing on the thousands of years preceding China's first unification. This is a huge and frankly unforgivable oversight. China was home to not one, but multiple inventions of agriculture, the growth of language families that still define the world today, and not least, one of the world's few pristine inventions of the state. That's what we're going to focus on today, and we have a fantastic guest to help us learn more about it. Professor Li Liu is one of the world's leading experts on the archaeology of Neolithic and Bronze Age China. She's the Sir Robert Ho Tung Professor in Chinese Archaeology at Stanford University and the author of several books, including The Archaeology of China from the Late Paleolithic to the Early Bronze Age, which I highly recommend to you, and The Chinese Neolithic, Trajectories to Early States, along with a staggering number of book chapters and journal articles. Her most recent work looks at the early brewing of alcohol around the world. Professor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for coming back. This is our second time chatting. I had a great time the first time. It was a fantastic interview, and I appreciate you making the time to chat with me again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so let's start with the state itself. The origin of the state has been one of the foundational concerns of prehistoric archaeology in China. Why is that? Why is there so much emphasis on the topic?
Yes, that is a very good question. We have to go back to the beginning of archaeology established as a discipline, and even before that. So first of all, we have to realize that Chinese has a very long history and a written history as well. So their obsession with the antiques and also with the ancient kings and heroes and emperors. So we understand the very crucial discovery was made in the late 19th centuries, and that is the decipherment of oracle bone inscriptions. And that was done by some Chinese scholars. So they realized on those oracle bones, they believed it was medicine, used as medicine, called them dragon bones. But some scholar recognized there were inscriptions on those so-called the dragon bones. And then they deciphered them. And then they realized that some of them are the name of kings belong to the Shang Dynasty. So this is the clue lead to the discovery of this late Shang capital city called Yinxu, as located in Henan. And this first time established this historical dynasty as a history before it was legendary. And the second very important discovery was made by a foreign scholar, is a Swedish geologist, J.G. Anderson. And he discovered the first Neolithic site in China is also located in Henan province. The name of this village is called Yangshao. So he found for the first time there was a Neolithic culture in China. It was unknown before him, and the discovery was made in 1921. So these two things together really started people pay attention to the very deep history in archaeology. But because Anderson's discovery was rather early, you know, this Yangshao culture can be traced back to the Neolithic. And many people think they were not a real civilization. And also they were probably not indigenous because Anderson traced the origin to Central Asia and then ultimately to the Near East. So he thinks that was a diffusion of this painted pottery which characterized this Neolithic culture. So then the third thing, very crucial happened is that in the late 19th century, a group of scholars, they had Western education and returned to China, and they want to search for the origin of Chinese civilization. So at this time, you know, we don't really distinguish what is state, what is dynasty, what is civilization. So those three concepts are interchangeable. And especially this dynasty. So people just think if you find the earliest dynasty, it must be a state because they're kings, right? So this Yinshu become the first target of the exhibition, scientific exhibition, led by Li Ji, who is later regarded as the father of Chinese archaeology. So this exhibition at Yinshu started in 1928 and last until 1937. And the scientific exhibition proved it was a capital city and confirmed it was the late capital of the Shang Dynasty. So this is really the beginning to form a tradition in Chinese archaeology, which is called historiographic orientation in archaeology, mainly to reconstruct an ancient history, and especially to search for the origin of the dynasties and the civilization. Also, we have to realize this time it was about the starting of the Second World War, and China was rather weak and was threatened by the Western powers. And so those intellectuals, they were motivated by this nationalism. They want to make China stronger. And also this history, the glorious history, is a part of a reconstruction of the Chinese past. And then it's also would help motivate people to build a new China. And so that is probably, if we go back to history, that was the beginning of this tradition emphasized on civilization or state. So this three concepts later become separated, you know, when people discuss and it's different concepts and use different criteria to measure them. Yeah, that it's really helped to establish this long-term tradition which emphasized on historiographic orientation, and it still is this way.
That's really interesting because it seems like it's such a powerful tradition. It seems to loom over pretty much every discussion of late Neolithic and Bronze Age archaeology in China is this overarching search for the state. I want to follow up on something that you mentioned at the very beginning when you were talking about the written histories and the legends of that past and the way in which those have gotten intertwined with the archaeology. Do you think that those later written records, of which there are many, they're extremely powerful and resonant still, do you think that those later written records can help us shed light on archaeological remains?
Yes and no. In many ways, it is a start. You know, one archaeologist that discovers something, and then they would immediately link that to a specific time period and probably the dynasties or even individuals. So that's it's a very powerful tool to help archaeologists to identify the artifacts if this during the historical period. So that like the dynasties, like Zhou dynasties, and so we have very clear record. And sometimes the findings, archaeological findings and historical records match to each other. So in those cases, it's very helpful and you don't have to take a lot of guesswork, right? But on the other hand, if we're talking about the prehistory without writing, and all those written documents were made maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years later. And so that is not so straightforward to match archaeological findings with the historical record, but people still try. And basically that could be the first or maybe the only possible sources to find the origin. So this is a very controversial issue. Some people think that this is a problem, and the other people think that that's our advantage. You know, we have a long written history. Why not to consult? But many Western sinologists are very critical about this, and they think they should be separated. And you should study historical record in their own right before you match to archaeology. My position is relatively in the middle. So I don't think, you know, you can completely trust the record because that would be modified through time, and who wrote them and why they were written. And all those questions need to be answered before you just match to the funding. So this kind of research method that lead to a lot of problems because their written record only have limited the names of individuals or dynasties or place names, but archaeological findings provide a lot more. And so when people try to match them, you know, some individuals or heroes become very, very busy. So everywhere, they as soon as they discover something important, so they would grab that individual, like the Yellow Emperor. So Yellow Emperor, there it seems his towns or his cities or his birthplace and his battlefield is all over China, and this one individual. So it's just basically impossible.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it seems like, yeah, there are real benefits and drawbacks to having that as a source of information because you risk reading every bit of archaeological data that you find through the lens of these much later written sources. But at the same time, you don't want to discount them entirely because it's probably not like they're making things up. So you end up in this weird space where you can take the hypercritical approach, but then you risk limiting your understanding of your archaeological data. But then if you're too credulous, if you believe too much what you read, then the archaeological data can't speak for itself.
Yes, exactly. But people would regard historical record very, very valuable. If you can really claim your finding has the source, has the origin in those records, and you can elevate the importance of your discovery, right? Mm-hmm. So that's become a common practice in Chinese archaeology.
Yeah, the incentives run very strongly in that direction. I mean, you can see the same thing. I feel like the same thing happened a great deal with Near Eastern archaeology and with the archaeology of the Aegean when, you know, everybody wanted this to be, you know, the tomb of Agamemnon or Agamemnon's death mask. And, you know, whatever Heinrich Schliemann found was going to be Homer's Troy. There's power in that, and there's power in the legends. And so it makes sense that you want to match up what you find in the ground to that. It's great public relations.
Yes, that's a great comparison.
So I want to come back to the state and to prehistory more specifically. What are the cultures or periods in Chinese prehistory that archaeologists believe saw the rise of the first state or states? I mean, if we're looking at the archaeological record, if we want to not let those written records influence us too much, how can we see a state in the archaeological record?
Yes, this is a very complicated issue, and it's not easy to answer, but I will try my best. I think archaeologically, we have to use a different criterion to measure if it was a state or not. So it's not just relied on historical record or to discover some important artifacts in one place. So state or cities, right? They were regional. So regional development, and you would see some material change or social organization change in a landscape rather than just one point. You will see a large site. And then you see, oh, there's a state. But this, how the state developed, they need interaction with the surrounding regions. So there's a supporting villages or small towns. Then there is a center, which would be the sitting place of the authority or elite. So this kind of organization developed would leave material remains. So we do survey to find out how the settlement pattern changes through time and see if the settlement pattern show hierarchical arrangement in a large region and how the center of this related to the surrounding smaller villages. So this kind of approach is commonly used in archaeology and it's beginning from the Near East. And then to other regions in China, we also adopted this region, this method to do a regional survey. So I was involved in a region called the Yiluo Basin. It's where we believe the earliest state emerged. And it's called Arlitou culture and located centered in the Arlitou side. So this basin is also located in Henan province. So the Henan is really the core area of Chinese civilization. So when we see the settlement pattern show hierarchical development, and there is a very large center and surrounded by the many smaller villages. So we would calculate and see how many levels of hierarchy may exist based on population density. Of course, the population density is calculated based on the site size. So there's many way of doing analysis, and that's only archaeologists can do this kind of analysis. There's no other method like a historical record. They cannot really help. So this is a major way we can tell if the states exist.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. So you would see a state as a spatial phenomenon, that when you have a state, that's going to leave a particular kind of record in the way that people live on the landscape, the way that they cluster in the landscape. And you're looking for tiers of settlement. So you have the center, you have something. So you're looking for, in the case of a state, it's usually at least three tiers, right? You have the largest center, then something in the middle, and then the lower levels of the hierarchy below that. And is that, am I correct in that understanding? Okay.
Yes, three tiers of a political organization, but in the settlement pattern, there will be four tiers because the lowest tier has no authority. They're just small villages and the peasants. Yeah, that's it's a model. You know, there's sometimes you cannot really reconstruct exactly, the organization. Reconstruct organization, but you give you a tendency to see how the social hierarchy developed.
Yeah, that's something that seems to work pretty well cross-culturally with archaeology, is looking for tiered settlement patterns. You see it in the Near East starting in the fourth millennium BC. You see a hierarchical tiered settlement pattern. You see it in Egypt in the early dynastic period. You see it in the Indus Valley civilization. So it seems to be a method. It works in the Americas as well. When you see that kind of tiered settlement pattern, it seems fairly clear that something has changed, even if the nature of the archaeological data doesn't allow us to dig into exactly what that is. Something has changed at that point.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, settlement pattern is just a one aspect we use to measure the social organization. And we still have to see other artifacts, which would show it was an elite class and there's political control. And also there are some maybe a system of exchange or some kind of relationship between center and the periphery. And maybe it was a world system, so-called, not so large world. So this new concept and method to study, has not been commonly practiced in China, although in several locations and people have adopted the method, the very thorough regional survey, a systematic full coverage survey. So that really helped us to understand the dynamics of social evolution in China, but only part of China.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Something that feels like it's been a big topic in Chinese archaeology recently is as more data has come in from areas, as there have been more excavations in areas outside the Central Plains and the Middle Yellow River, that to some extent that's changing our picture of prehistoric China, seeing large walled sites in the Sichuan Basin, really rich burial remains at the mouth of the Yangtze, the really detailed regional surveys in the Shandong Peninsula, that's somewhat changing our picture of the late Neolithic. Do you think on the basis of that data that we should still see state formation in China as something that happened primarily in one region, or do you think it's more of a multi-regional phenomenon at this point?
That's another very interesting question. And I think the answers are changing through time based on the new discoveries of archaeological sites. I think that's very early in 1980s, you know, before archaeology get into the question of state formation. So there was always a searching for the earliest dynasties. And also the archaeological data and excavations focus on large sites like capital cities. And some sinologists in 1980s believe that only the Shang dynasty and the late Shang dynasty, like Yinxu, was the first state. They have bureaucratically matched to the criteria of the state. But in the 1990s, this kind of belief changed, and mainly because Alito culture, after decades of excavation, we know much better about this location, this site. And it seems this site also matched to the level of the state. Then there's a lot of discussion about earliest dynasty, called the Xia Dynasty, and Alito probably was a capital city of the Xia Dynasty. So the state formation very much focused on the Alito culture, and the date to about 1800 BC, compared to the Yinxu, which is like 1100 BC. So it's already, you know, several hundred years early. And there's quite a long debate about Alito. Some people believe it was not a state, but most people believe it was a state and also related to the Xia Dynasty. And a recent discovery made in China changed this scenario again. And mainly because there were three major discoveries made in large cities or large polities. One is Liangzhu culture, which is in the lower Yangtze River, and is in the recent years made a newspaper headline, and because they found not only a large city in the center, but also many irrigation systems, you know, like water control, water dams built along the mountains. So it was the first irrigation system man-made in human history. So, you know, date to more than 5,000 years ago. And that is, this is one major discovery. And another one is called the Taosi. and that is located in Plateau, North Plateau in Shanxi province. And then, again, it's a large city with the city walls. And they have this kind of astonishing observatory. So they build this kind of structure to observe the sunrise in different seasons. So they can probably use this method to determine the seasonality. And that may be the source of the power held by the elite in this city. And the third discovery was even more recently discovered even north of the North Plateau. It's called the Shimao site. And that is the date to 23 to 1800 BC. And it was a huge stone-made wall city, and with several layers of city walls. And it's built of stones and with the citadel in the center. And the people seems also made human sacrifice before the foundation. And then they have a jade object inserted into the walls, into the city walls. And there's other artifacts. So there's this really new discovery, especially located in this region, is like a demarcation between agriculture and pastoralism, and what used to be regarded as a periphery rather than the core of civilization. But now it seems it's a core in that region. So those three sites or regions, if you discuss their development and the level of social complexity, they can also be classified as states. So that is prehistorical, and there's no writing system at all. And then we're talking about pre-dynastic states.
That's really interesting. And it feels like, I wonder the extent to which Chinese archaeology is going to be in a position similar to the archaeology of Egypt was a few decades ago, as there were more and more excavations on the pre-dynastic period. And so the invention of the state kept getting pushed back and back and back. And instead of the emergence of a single dynasty at a single point in time that's associated with historical records, you have to dig back even further and you see small competing states before you see the emergence of a larger and more unified state.
Yes. So I think that is a quite interesting comparison. And I think in China, it was a period before the dynastic period. There was a time multiple states developed. They were smaller than the later dynastic states. And some of them are competing with each other, like Taosi and Shimao. They were apparently competing with each other, but they were kind of short-lived. Mm-hmm. So they lasted for several hundred years, then disappeared. And by the time early Tao culture emerged, there is no competition exist with early Tao. And if we compare the political control over the landscape, and those early Neolithic states are rather small, they have probably political hegemony over their basins or their local region. But when we compare with early Tao, early Tao is not only has a core area in their Yilu Basin, but also they send the military and to control other regions. There's hundreds of kilometers away from the center. And why they do that is to control resource. And there's a new resource become very powerful and attractive to the elite, and that is metal, this bronze. So that's in China, the state, dynasty, and civilization, and the Bronze Age occurred about the same time, right? So the bronze become precious, and also the power embedded in the bronze ritual objects. So it's not bronze knife, bronze earring or nose ring, these are small things. It was a vessel. And the vessel was used for ritual activities, and particularly drinking vessels. So those very well-made, elaborate drinking vessels were probably used for ancestral worship. And there, the power of those elite their the source of the power ultimately come from their ancestors. If they can claim their ancestors are superior than others and have more power to say that, if they have more power than other people's ancestors, and they will, of course, they will attract the followers. So this is kind of a new way of control in the Chinese history. And when we see the article culture, some material remains and identified to article culture occurred hundreds of miles, 100 kilometers away from their core area. And we assume those of the population move to the new place, establish the outpost of article power. And if we look at outposts, the locations of those outposts, they were all close to the resources. Mm-hmm. And the resources would include metals like copper and salt. So the salt is can be controlled if they're concentrated to be produced in one location. So that's very easy to be controlled. And this kind of control of salt has become a common political tools held by the later emperors. So there's all state-controlled salt production in China.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
It seems like you have this first period of early state formation, but the states are small. Like, I think I read that you have a small fortified center every 30 to 50 kilometers or so. So that's a pretty small state. And what you see with the Erlitou culture is a shift in scale, that things get much bigger, the elites get more powerful, they're able to find a more powerful basis for their legitimacy. And that's something I want to ask you a little bit more about, is we have these elite groups. You mentioned the power of their ancestral lineage, the rituals that they use to support that. Is that the basis for elite power? I mean, are they, in what ways do we see political power being intertwined with ancestral lineages, with ritual? Is there, like, what makes them powerful? What makes them able to rule, I guess?
That's a question. Fascinating, but not easy to answer. One, people study state formation or urbanism, compare China with the Western world. And then several archaeologists pointed out that China was unique. It's not the same as the Near East or Egypt. So they believe, for example, Guang Zhizhang from Harvard University, he suggests that China, the urbanism or equivalent to state formation, is not relied on the population nucleation and economic development or technology development. It was relied on political control and religious control. And how it can be done and why it was the way developed in this path, it's not easy to describe or to find out. But that was the phenomena K.C. Zhang observed. And this view has been accepted by many archaeologists. And I believe that China is special and political control over economic development in terms of state formation. But I think that is in the recent years changed gradually because of new discovery and the excavations at Erlitou and Yinxi and also the capital city of Zhou Dynasty all revealed large workshops, craft production. So it's not the only bronze vessels were produced in those centers, but also other artifacts like bone objects and pottery objects and some elite, some for elite consumption, but other for commoners' consumption. So this is a combination of political control as well as economic development. So those elites may control the craft production as well. So this, if you look at it from this perspective, it's not much difference between, you know, from the Near East. And so we have to reevaluate our view about the state formation in China. So, of course, there was a political and religious power embedded in those bronze vessels. And there's a kind of belief system. You know, the bronze are, they have a special meaning, and these wealth and political power intertwined together. But at the same time, how can you sustain a large population in the center? They have to do something. You know, only a small group of people cast the bronze. And other people, you know, they have to do something to support themselves and also to sustain this center, the political center. So I think the economic development and specialization in some craft production also important. But that's just the beginning that archaeologists recognize this importance.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating point that you make there. And I wonder the extent to which we artificially separate those things into different categories. We artificially separate economics from politics, from religion, in a way that the ancient people themselves might not have done. I mean, I think that in the Near East, I think that like temple complexes as an example of that, where there is no real distinction between the religious authority of the priests who are serving the god who is thought to be literally present there, and the king has some sort of special relationship with that deity and with the temple complex serving as its patron, but it's also a craft workshop. So I think we want to draw like clean distinctions between those things, but I feel like that may not have been the case for ancient people.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, for the analytical purposes, we made a very clear distinction between economics and politics, but and for the ancient people, they were all together.
Yeah, so I want to finish up by asking you a kind of a macabre question, but it's something that that has come up a lot, and you mentioned it as we've been talking today. Human sacrifice, it shows up repeatedly throughout the Neolithic in a bunch of different places. It shows up in the Bronze Age. How do we know when we're looking at the archaeological record, A, that we're dealing with human sacrifice, and B, what purposes do you think it served for the groups that were carrying it out?
Yes, I think some human skeletons discovered in archaeological sites, looks like they were ritually buried, so in the like threw in the pit. It's hard to tell they were sacrificed. They could be enemy and be killed and just dumped in some place. But other times you can see the form of skeletons. They were especially arranged in special ways or buried in special ways. So then you can be sure they were sacrificed. For example, at Shimao, you know, the city I just mentioned, they found more than 7 pits filled with the skulls. And those skulls come from young female, almost entirely. Each place would have a dozen skulls. And then they tested DNA and found that those, at least one of them, so they did not test everyone, but at least one of them should come from the northeast. So there's 100 kilometers away. And then could be the enemy. But why they sacrifice female, young female, we don't really know. That is really, we just people speculate. You know, the reason. So this is one example. And Yinxu, that's the late Shang capital city. And there's a different story because there's a written record. So in the oracle bone inscriptions, they clearly identified the sacrifice, human sacrifice, or a group of people called the Qiang. So this Qiang, where does Qiang come from? Is it one group of people or is a general term refer to people from some direction or from their enemies is controversial. People have different opinions. But these Qiang people most likely come from the Northwest. So those the pastoralist group in hundreds of kilometers away. And they were captured from the battlefield and they were taken to the capital city to be sacrificed. So they were, it looks like they were treated as animals and brought into the capital city. And the king even to receive those Qiang people to be brought in. And so then they were probably kept in the capital city for a period of time. And when they have a ritual ceremony or they need a sacrifice, so then they would make those people and animals and other objects as sacrificial items. They were not really treated as a human. They were just treated as the same as other animals and objects.
It's pretty bleak stuff, but it feels like a good reminder that often when we see the birth of a state or the birth of a civilization, those can be built very strongly on distinctions between us and them, between insider and outsider, and that humans, that's one of the purposes that human sacrifice can serve.
Yes, I think that was very well described, and certainly it was the situation in China.
Well, on that somewhat macabre note, Professor, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a fascinating conversation, and thank you for all of your work on this topic. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.